Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So, welcome to this Friday the 13th. With a very wonderful kirtan like we just had, we can certainly ward off any inauspicious aspects of this day. So, thank you. Today, we're reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, first canto, 18th chapter, Parikshit cursed by a Brahmin boy, text 38 to 46. Now, the topic today is democracy versus monarchy. And so I wanted to start by doing something a little different, and that is by asking you a couple of questions. Because I think if we get some answers to these questions, then it'll help us to understand the subject matter when we go through the text, and we're going to concentrate on text number 43 today. Okay, so here's the question. Have the mics ready, because I hope someone will, more than one person will give us a response. Question number one. Who here is willing to live under monarchy, and why? Okay, so first answer, it depends on the king. So any other, because it's two, is are you willing and why? Shreshwar. Okay, we need to get the mic, if we can just do that real quick.
After a couple of years in office, JFK turned to one reporter and said, you know, all the people really want is a good king. But the king needs good ministers. Woe to the king who does not listen to good ministers.
So it depends on the king, depends on good ministers. Yeah.
I would live under a king because a lot of the decision-making that voters have to make would be pretty much eliminated. There's so much anxiety about, oh, who am I going to vote for? Who's the best candidate? You wouldn't have to worry about that every 6 months or so.
Okay. Relieves anxiety. Go for it.
On what Mike was saying, there's a school of thought that the average person either isn't well educated enough on the issues or just plain isn't intelligent enough to elect his own leaders. But a worldwide kingdom would be great, because if we had a proper king and ministers or whatever, because it would just be managed better, because there's really no scarcity. It's just this total mismanagement.
A monarchy, that's what I would prefer, but the person who is king should be qualified enough, and his council members should also have a standard of qualifications that should pass before they can pass out any judgment.
We've heard that the king has to be qualified, has to have qualified ministers. The people may not be educated enough to make the best choice, and so therefore that's... anybody have anything else? The ladies? Is Krishna conscious? You have something? Anybody else? Nothing. Okay, Kalakanta.
In a democracy, it seems no one can do anything. It's so difficult to get any kind of movement. You know, we're just kind of stuck in this battle, non-stop battle.
Clashing interests and Washington gridlock. Yeah. Okay. Is there a difference in your minds between a theistic and an atheistic? a monarchy being theistic and democracy being atheistic. Is that in anybody's mind? Do they think like that? That demon crazy, and that democracy is just for demons, or
I think so, because when you're in democracy, you want to, like, you have to be secular. Like, even though, like, America was founded with forefathers who were, like, trying to be Christian secretly, like, they're still trying to be secular, and they just want to have their own personal interests, and that's why they're more, like, atheist. As monotheistic, like, kings, and they're really, like, God-conscious, unless they're, like, Henry VIII.
Okay, so thank you for that. So with that background, let's take a look at text number 43. We'll chant to Sanskrit and read Prabhupada's translation and purport, and then explore a little bit about what the Bhagavatam has to say about democracy versus monarchy.
The king and monarchy, and why? Because the kings were, to my knowledge, responsible for the wars, and they actually fought in the wars, the kings did. When they didn't just go out and start a war they weren't going to fight in themselves. So choose a monarchy because the king, he would also be out there in the fight.
True leader. Let's see what the Bhagavatam has to say about this at text number 43. So let me just do the word meanings here. Alakshmane being abolished, Naradeva monarchio, namni of the name, Rata Anga Pono, the representative of the Lord, I am this Anga, O my boy, Loka in this world, Tada, he at once, chora, thieves, prachura, too much, anakshati, vinakshati, vanquishes, arakshamane, being not protected, avirutavat, like lambs, shanat, at once. Alakshamane, naradeva namni. Ratangapanav ayam angaloka. Tadahi chora prachuro vinakshati. Arakshamano vivarudha vachanat. Enchant, please.
Shamane Naradeva Namni Pratanga Pana Vayamanga Loga
Dani Chaura Chulo Vinakshati
Dani Chaura Chulo Vinakshati
Okay, thank you. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. My dear boy, the Lord who carries the wheel of a chariot is represented by the monarchical regime. And when this regime is abolished, the whole world becomes filled with thieves, who then at once vanquish the unprotected subjects like scattered lambs. Purport. According to Srimad Bhagavatam, the monarchical regime represents the Supreme Lord, the personality of Godhead. The king is said to be the representative of the absolute personality of Godhead because he is trained to acquire the qualities of God to protect the living beings. The Battle of Kurukshetra was planned by the Lord to establish the real representative of the Lord, Maharaj Yudhisthira. An ideal king, thoroughly trained by culture and devotional service, with the martial spirit, makes a perfect king. Such a personal monarchy is far better than the so-called democracy of no training and responsibility. The thieves and rogues of modern democracy seek election by misrepresentation of votes, and the successful rogues and thieves devour the mass of population. One trained monarch is far better than hundreds of useless ministerial rogues. And it is hinted herein that by abolition of the monarchical regime, like that of Maharaj Parikshit, the mass of the people become open to many attacks of the age of Kali. They are never happy in an overtly advertised form of democracy. The results of such a kingless administration is described in the following verses. Hare Krishna. So this verse appears in a series of verses that we're covering today that were spoken by the sage Shamaka Rishi, after he realized what his son, Sringi, had done to Maharaj Parikshit. He put the dead snake, you know the story, he put the dead snake on him to insult him because he thought that the king did not respect his father. Of course, it's described in earlier verses here that when the king awoke from his trance, he saw the snake on his neck and he simply cast it aside, meaning that he didn't take it very seriously. But the boy had taken it seriously, and when Shamaka Rishi had found out what he had done, cursing the king, he lamented. And these are his words here. And he goes on to describe how the people will suffer greatly due to the lack of let's call him a Vedic king, a religious king. And so therefore Prabhupada gives us this assessment of democracy when compared to that. It's interesting when we compare monarchy versus democracy, we actually have a chance to look at the Bhagavatam not necessarily being a historical document from many centuries ago, but we start to see how it converges on our modern times. And that's done in two ways, both in terms of the instructions to a king, as well as in terms of why historically, let's take the United States for example, why historically the United States rejected a king in favor of democracy. We get a good look at that. And that's shown if we take a look at a document like the Declaration of Independence. I don't know if any of you recall what the Declaration of Independence actually says, but it pretty much parallels some of the things which are described in these verses about what happens to the citizens when you have the king, when you don't have a good king. Some of the same things that are described in the Bhagavatam we see in history 200 years ago in the Declaration of Independence. So I just thought I would read a couple of things. Why? Because the Declaration of Independence is a document composed why the United States, the colonies in the United States, declared themselves independent of the King of England or monarchy. These are some of the reasons they give in the document. He refused his assent to laws the most wholesome and necessary for the public good. In other words, the citizens are the real victims here when we talk about the government, bad government. Whether it's monarchy or democracy, who are the real victims?
the citizens are the big. So they're saying that there were laws that they had passed for the whole that were wholesome and necessary for the public good, but the king was not interested in them. Therefore, he did not give his consent to them. It says here that he erected a multitude of new offices. Here you go, the bureaucracy, right? he erected a multitude of new offices and sent hither swarms of officers to harass our people and eat out their substance. I mean, this is right from the Bhagavatam, isn't it? I mean, how they'll devour the citizens is described in the verse. That's what we find in the Declaration of Independence, that same language. For imposing taxes on us without our consent. That's another thing. He has abdicated government here by declaring us out of his protection and waging war against us. A king waging war against their own citizens. Again, that's something that we find in descriptions of Kali Yuga. But we're reading the Declaration of Independence here, not descriptions from the Bhagavatam. He plundered our seas, ravaged our coasts, burned our towns, and destroyed the lives of our people. One last thing. It says here, he is at this time transporting large armies of foreign mercenaries to complete the works of death, desolation, and tyranny, already begun with circumstances of cruelty and purified, sacredly paralleled in the most barbarous ages and totally unworthy of the head of a civilized nation. Anyway, so these just give you some idea how the Bhagavatam is coming alive in our own recollection. Just 200 and some odd years ago, people recognizing a monarchy that had gone wrong stated all the same things that the Bhagavatam tells us is truth about the nature of bad monarchy. Now, on the other side of the coin, there is this, the Bhagavatam also brings us our modern history into perspective when we look at how Chanaka Pandit, you know, Chanaka Pandit is mentioned in the Bhagavatam in the 11th canto, or is it 11th or 12th canto? 12th canto. He's mentioned in the 12th canto as advising King Chandragupta. Now, so when we look at Chanaka Pandit, he has many instructions that are given on how a king should be trained. And so those are, again, within our historical reach, within our historical understanding. It's not just stories from the Bhagavatam that are so long ago that we can't touch. Chanaka Pandit is there in the Bhagavatam, and that same person has given various instructions on how a king should be trained. We're going to go over those in a little while, but I just wanted to make that connection that this is a very real and approachable subject for us. We're citizens. We have the right to choose, and some of you expressed your views about monarchy or democracy before we began. So we're affected, and so we should have some perspective and outlook on this subject. ours is a theistic worldview, and so the idea about government should also reflect that, and indeed it does. But I, when I read this purport, I was surprised, because we talk about monarchy or kings, and we say they are, as described in the verse here, Naradeva. Anybody can say what Naradeva? Give us a translation. Representative of God, but something more specifically, Naradeva. Among men. Yeah, Naradeva. Among men, the representative of God. Nara means human and Deva, God. So that this is our conception of monarchy, that they are the representative of God. And Prabhupada says here in the purport, the king is said to be the representative of the absolute personality of Godhead. And then he makes a very interesting statement. says, because he is trained to acquire the qualities of God to protect the living beings. So, I mean, how does one become Narideva? Who's Narideva? Is it someone that drops from the heavens that's Narideva? Or is it someone, as Prabhupada said here, who is trained? I think that that's a very important distinction because monarchy, as it was historically practiced in the modern times, based their authority on what they called divine right to rule. So what's the difference between Narideva and divine right to rule that was exhibited by kings in modern times? Training, yes. Right, right. That's a very important point, because sometimes you read about or see about, depicted in movies or whatever, these kings who are completely, you know, corrupt. You know, they're drunkards, womanizers, or something like that. And then, but everyone's going along with it. You know, they're just like so, you know, respectful and afraid to do anything against the king, isn't it? I mean, they do that. Why? Because this. Sorry. Right. By qualification, action, by training. But people accepted these kings, no matter how corrupt they were, to a point, obviously, because basically society accepted this idea of divine right, that there was some reason why this person was the king and that we all had to follow and we couldn't question that. Yeah.
Death or the guillotine, you know, at least in like popular depictions of monarchy and like through the history in the West, you know.
Well, that's how they could control people, right? They didn't have to try people. Same things we read in the Declaration. They didn't have to go through trials, just trials. And they just put people in the guillotine that were against them or something like that. And they had the right to do that without any impunity. They couldn't be punished for that. This is what, you know, people did. And so therefore, rogues took over those places. There wasn't proper training, and therefore the whole idea of monarchy disappeared. But as you may be aware, any civilization, they have a sort of a worldview, a philosophy which guides them. And so if this idea of divine right was there, what changed that idea of divine right where people could actually say, well, No, we can declare our independence from the king. What philosophy? Does anybody have any idea what kind of philosophy developed where people could actually be sort of mentally, psychologically, intellectually free from this idea of divine, actually, Clayton?
It started with Voltaire and Rousseau in the 18th century. And maybe before, maybe was it John Locke, mm-hmm. English writer, who also mm-hmm. in the 17th century started to write about... Oh, no, wait, maybe he wrote... I can't remember what John Locke wrote about, actually.
No, John Locke is correct.
but I don't know what... I mean, we say that there was the Enlightenment of the 18th century, but, mm-hmm. I mean, really, from our point of view, it's not much of Enlightenment. But materialists think of it as the Enlightenment because there are advances in material science and... So many there were more advances in medicine, and but I don't know. What would you say the name of the philosophy is that gave rise to democracy?
I have a name, but maybe somebody else has it. Oh, sorry, sir.
They say that this world is unreal, that there's no God in control. It is produced of sex desire and knows no cause other than lust. So once you kick out the idea of authority, that there is a supreme authority, then anything goes. Mm-hmm. That's Rousseau's social contract. It's all about human beings. It's not about God anymore.
I thought I remembered something about like deism and the understanding mm-hmm. that God was almost like a watchmaker or something who basically built this whole thing, this earth and everything in it and just set it into effect, you know, and so it could play out in front of his eyes, and that was a popular belief.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's also correct. Go ahead, Kishore. Materialism is also there, yeah. One of the ideas, prominent ideas, was called natural law, a natural law. And let me just read to you a little bit about natural law, and then I'll give you a connection to the Declaration of Independence, which actually threw off the monarchy. Natural laws are those that are believed to be morally righteous laws, believed to have been the will of a greater power than humans. This does not necessarily mean that it is the will of God. Rather, it means that these laws are above the human ability to create them. These laws are sometimes referred to as divine laws. An excellent example is the case of human rights, which are now known to be inherent, inalienable, indivisible, and universal. So this idea of natural law, actually, it comes from the Greeks. Aristotle is the first one to propound this, and it runs throughout several centuries of thought. John Locke picked this up and built the basis of democracy on it. Our modern human rights is based on this thing that people have certain rights. And that's reflected right in the Declaration of Independence. Just in case any of you thought this was a Christian nation, it's really not. It's more like the deism you were talking about, because it doesn't have anything to do with God here. In the Declaration of Independence, when they say that that the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them. I don't know if that word God is in the original. It may be in this translation, in this presentation. But they talk about being endowed with inalienable rights. It's distant, but it comes from this idea of natural law, not from a theistic, a truly theistic idea that the king or the leader in society represents the personality of Godhead. And so this natural law theory is there, and it results in what we have today, a modern democracy where we don't need leadership that's tied directly to the will of the Supreme Lord. And so therefore, when that intellectual bridge was crossed, then people could form democracies and not have to worry about this idea of divine right of kings. But for that reason, we don't accept democracy. It's based in ideas which aren't necessarily linked with the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and most importantly, it's not grounded in any kind of training of kings. When we talk about Naradeva, we're not talking about the irresponsible life of a playboy king who's has the divine right to do anything he wants, but we're talking about an individual who's gone through training, who's developed his character, and those are the basis, as Prabhupada says in the purport here, of their right to rule, their character. And so some of that training is described by Chanaka Pandit in this book, which is a collection of his teachings called Maxims of Chanakya. Okay. Chanaka Pandit was a Brahmin who historically lived, I don't know, how many centuries ago? Does anybody say? Before Christ? 300 B.C.? During the time of Alexander. Okay, that's a good idea. During the time of Alexander, that's a Western historical reference. He was a Brahmin that that advised Maharaj Chandragupta, who was able to repel the invasion of India in India of Alexander the Great as he conquered over the Middle East and toward India. When he came to India, he couldn't conquer. His armies had to turn back. Was he killed in India, Alexander? He was wounded in India. Okay. And what Chanaka is said to have been the Brahmin that advised the king that was able to repel him from his attack in India. Okay. And so as a teacher, as a Brahmin, Prabhupada tells about Chanakya that he didn't take a lot of favors from the king for his advice. Shreshwar Prabhu was telling us at the beginning that the king has to have good ministers. Well, that's when he'd accept monarchy, if the king has good ministers like Chanaka Pandit. So he was a minister of Chandragupta, and he advised him on how to operate the kingdom in a God-conscious way as a Brahmin. Now, Sringi had cursed Maharaj Prickett, and his father, Shamak Rishi, correctly said that now we, meaning the Brahmins, will take the blame for all the suffering of society. Previously, the Brahmins were meant to benefit society by giving good instructions to the king and all the classes of society. But when the Brahmins became corrupt, then the Kshatriyas quickly followed because they no longer had a source of good advice. So Chanakya was giving good advice and this training that Prabhupada points out in today's purport for the king. So here are some of the things that he says about the duties and qualities of the ruler. The ruler who has controlled his senses is religious, venerates ascetics, is righteous and interested in the welfare of his subjects, is competent to protect his people. Notice how these things are, again, completely opposite to what the king, King George, I think he was doing when the Declaration of Independence was written. The ruler shall rule his country, devoted to truth and righteousness, and defeat enemy forces, righteously protect his territory. The ruler in whose country the prana of sound om chanted by the learned flourishes, becomes skillful and free from affliction. He is a ruler who is the protector of the orphaned, refuge of the refugees, guide to the afflicted, protector of the frightened, support of the unsteady, the friend, the relative, the master, the benefactor, the teacher, father, mother, and brother to all. So, no one was exploited during the rule of a king like this. And we have the example of just a couple of weeks ago, we celebrated Ram Navami, the appearance of Lord Ramachandra. And so his kingdom, he ruled like what to everybody? Father. He was like a father to all the citizens. And so that's the mood. Of course, today, due to governments who are in the position of father acting in ways which are exploitative, no one wants to hear that you know, the government's like your father or something like that. You kind of even cringe when you hear that. You know, you think, oh, my God. But that is the type of the relationship that was there. He says here that the characteristics of a ruler are five. He gives up wealth in favor of the needy, loves virtues, enjoys pleasure in the company of friends and relatives, is anxious to learn the sciences, and is a fighter in war. So that one's for you. Kshatriyas, as was pointed out earlier by Joe, they lead the fighting. They just don't send. Prabhupada would say, you know, how the politicians are just sitting back, you know, safe and sending people out to the front and to be killed in the wars and things like that. But that's not the ideal king. The ideal king is a fighter in the war, led by his example. And I'll just read one final instruction here. It's kind of packed, so there's some things that follow it, but it gives some idea about how the training of the king has to go on. Because, again, Prabhupada is stressing that Naradeva just doesn't mean someone drops from the heaven or they have some kind of divine right. They have to be trained and they have to develop the right character. So Chanka says, and you can imagine him teaching this lesson, the ruler should learn one quality from each of the the ruler should learn one quality each from the lion and the crane, four from the cock, five from the crow, six from the dog, and three from the monkey. Okay. So we're going to give you a test now and see how you... So one from the lion and the crane. So what should one learn from the lion? Okay. One should learn from the lion to undertake a task well prepared, whether it is a big one or a small one. Okay? Apparently lions, you know, prepare well for whatever they're going to do. Okay. So there was also one from the crane. The crane. What should one learn from the crane?
One leg.
Yes. An outsider's perspective. Okay, anything else? Anyone?
Steady.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's
alert.
Okay, yeah. Let's read what he says. Like a crane, the learned one should control his senses and, knowing the aptness of time and place, accomplish all tasks. So, those things are necessary. Alertness, you know, concentration, as mentioned. Yeah, good. Okay, now there are four things from the cock or the rooster. And we hear them at our house every morning. I don't know if I've learned all these lessons, but four things from the cock. So what are four things? Discipline. Getting up early, yeah, okay. Discipline, anything else? There are four things we're looking at. Regularity. Huh? Right. Okay. Four things. Getting up in time. Fighting. That's actually why the guy next to us has these things. He's from Puerto Rico, and they have a lot of cockfighting in Puerto Rico. Sometimes I wonder. Well, there's one thing. He gives a lesson here, too. Donkey's one of these people, so. Okay. Getting up in time, fighting, division of responsibility among allies, and enjoyment after attacking oneself. Okay. From the crow, one should learn five things. The crow. To snatch away things. Guards. Okay. Anything else? This is Kshatriya training. This is Kshatriya training here. Okay. Okay. Well, there's something about everyone here. I'm not sure it's mingled, but maybe it has something to do with that. Okay. Cleverness. Mm-hmm. All right. Okay. There's intimacy and secret action, catch in time, unruffled behavior, and distrust of everyone. Okay. Well, the next one probably gives us a little hint at six things we should learn from a dog. Faithful is one, yes. Light sleeping, you said, yes, that's one. Obedience, yes. Service, that's there. Yeah, that's there. Yes, that's there too. That's, very greedy. Well, that one was not on the list here. Anything else? Okay, six things. This is good. I mean, we're followers. So we got this one better than any of the rest ones. Six things: desire for much, satisfaction with little, deep slumber, quick awakening, devotion to master, and bravery. So these things we learn from the dog. And finally, from the donkey, three things should be learned. Hard work, yes. Yes. That's another one. Because Prabhupada gave us the examples. There are three here listed here. Yeah, that's there. Persistence is there as well, yes. Huh? Tolerance. Yeah, that's also a quality there. So, diplomacy. From a donkey? Okay, from a donkey, three things should be learned. To carry the burden even though tired, not to mind heat or cold, and to trudge ever satisfied. So, I mean, these are the things that somehow or another they're, you know, appropriate to training a king, you know, how to do all these things. It says, the discerning one who practices these 20 virtues mentioned conquers all enemies and himself remains unconquerable. So these are some lessons that we have for the king. The monkey? Did we miss the monkey? No, there wasn't a monkey in here. Maybe, no, this. I said monkey? Donkey. Of course, there are things we can learn from the monkey also. What can we learn from the monkey? We can learn what not to do from the monkey, yes. Not what is it called, Vairagya? What kind of? Market the Vairagya. Yeah, not that good. Actually, in training the Vedic kings, there are a lot of these kind of animal lessons you learn from animals. And I think not just in the Vedic, but in other traditions too. Like I was taking Tai Chi from Joe there for a while, and there were all the moves we had animal names. There was the crane and other moves, isn't it like that? And so in yoga they have also, you know, the different animal analogies. So Yeah, well, this type of physical training, spiritual training, intellectual training, were divisions for the training kshatriyas. What does it say in the Bhagavad Gita? What is the verse which describes the qualities by which a kshatriya works? Can you? Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. I mean, compare that to, say, our modern leaders, or some of the, let's say, before democracy really came, there were a lot of corrupt kings. I think you mentioned Louis the 14th, Henry the 8th. Okay. Well, Louis the 14th was just as bad. You know, these people were. Did they have any of these kind of qualities? How could they protect their citizens? And ultimately, although, again, it's something that today people sort of shun from protection or sort of a paternalistic view of the king or the government. People don't want that. But that is the ideal that's there in the Vedic model with this, the idea of Naradeva. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. meditation of a crane, which you said. And from the dog, light sleeper. That's what I said.
Right, right.
And he eats less and he leaves the house and learns in the Gurukul. So, so very similar to what we did.
Right. Yeah, Kalkant.
The lion is said to have this quality of not doing much, but whatever they do with full intensity. That said, being prepared, it wasn't quite as specific. So that's what I remember. The lion is just little thing or big thing, but it's full intensity, full attention.
Mm. Another good lesson. Sure.
You said we reject democracy. Certainly Prabhupada said that. At the same time, we set up this kind of democratic body. And there's a famous incident in Vrindavan 69 when Prabhupada came. One of the things he did in May 69 was he saw a squabble between Vrindavan Swami and Hargriva about who's in charge. And so they were going back and forth. And Prabhupada suggested they have a council. Hargriva said, but that's democracy. And Prabhupada said, yes, democracy is passe.
Care what the system is if it's Krishna conscious.
Right.
So is that kind of like the synthesis to the...
Yeah, well, that's one of the reasons why I wanted to first getting some views from everybody just to see how people think, because I think in general people today, including devotees, including in ISKCON, with the idea of just someone having a monarchical kind of position, it's like people are not ready for that. People don't want to accept that, you know. And it's because of the bad experience we have with monarchs having absolute power. Even in ISKCON, you hear this phrase probably more than any place else. Absolute power corrupts absolutely.
Highway.
Right. And we've had bad experience in ISKCON of someone having concentrated power and misusing it. And therefore, that's what the rise of democracy was all about, you know, to diffuse that absolute power, to give sovereignty to the people. That's what it describes here, that in the Declaration of Independence, they're saying that, well, sovereignty is not in one person, the king. It's in every individual equally. And so that sovereignty is given up in a democracy to participate in a system. And so that's what we're used to. That's what we're conditioned to. And so to throw that off and all of a sudden start installing monarchs, and it was bad enough just installing temple presidents, you know, and things like that. What to speak of, you know, a monarch, you know, what, you know, who's qualified to do it? So training has to be there. And so, yeah, therefore in ISKCON we do have, you know, different traces of monarchy. But in working in the Constitution, I've found that there is this idea of power being, you know, recognized as being full power, being recognized, say, in the GBC, for instance, not necessarily an elected body, but as the representative who's received the grace and mercy by their qualifications to have that kind of authority. Well, the same point.
In the beginning of the class, you were talking about how governments can become extremely demoniac even against their own citizens.
Yeah.
I was in the kitchen. I couldn't hear very well. Is that a description of days gone past, or is that Kali Yuga?
It's Kali Yuga, and it's a description from the Declaration of Independence, how, you know, within our own experience 200 plus years ago, the government, the King of England, of Great Britain, was acting in such demonic ways to, you know, this country and the people here. Like that, so it's the influence of Kali Yuga, yes.
Is it possible for the citizens to be so ill-informed that the same very thing could be going on today, right now, anywhere in the world?
Oh, of course.
Where the governments are demoniac and they're actually not working for the protection of the real interest of the citizens, but in reality, just completely exploiting them, overtaxing them, and all kinds of them. That's possible.
Yeah, of course there is. There's a gentleman called Bhave. What's his name?
In India? Bhave?
No. Okay. There's also in India, there's a guy that he campaigns by doing hunger strikes against corruption in India. What's his name? No, right. Huh? He, right now, goes on hunger strikes and things like that to try to bring to people's attention how the leadership is corrupt in India and taking crores and crores of rupees from the people. So that goes on. I mean, in every country we can see that. It's a fact. Any other points anyone has? Yes?
Came, you know, from what you were reading, the democracy came in being because the monarchy was so bad. So now we have democracy, and then we're seeing the same problems here, you know, like you're... So it seems like, hey, what's the difference?
Well, the difference is that this is the influence, as Bala was saying, pointing out, of Kali Yuga, and therefore Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has come, and he's given an opportunity for us to right the ship on the strength of the holy name of the Lord. Many things can be accomplished by chanting Hare Krishna, all the way from redeveloping our loving relationship to Sri Sri Radha and Krishna, to righting the ills of society. And the good ship ISKCON is sort of charged with that responsibility. Therefore, when I joined this movement, one of the first assignments I got was to come right here to Gainesville, Florida, where a devotee was running for the position of in government. And although chances of winning weren't very large, still, it was a preaching engagement, and the truth of spiritual life, the necessities of the soul, came out in the preaching, political preaching that was going on. So we can't change everything, but we can do what we can in Lord Chaitanya's service, to Srila Prabhupada's service, to help people be relieved from the sufferings of bad government. Okay? So we'll end there. Someone want to chant the Prasadam prayer?